Welcome to the Business of Behavior podcast, hosted by Dr. Becca Tagg. We support clinicians who have been bitten by the entrepreneurial bug, looking to strengthen their practice to better serve their clients, employees, and themselves.
Hello, and welcome to the Business of Behavior podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Becca Tagg. I am here today with an exciting episode, super exciting for me because it's not just me talking, so I get to talk to somebody else, and I'm excited to have Shannon Biaggi here with us today.
Hi, guys.
Shannon, welcome. So if you guys are active on Facebook or some other social media, or if you've attended some of the regional or even national conferences, or you're a book nerd, my guess is that you have seen Shannon's name or interacted with her. She's the CEO of Chief Motivating Officers. It's an organization devoted to the dissemination of organizational behavior management globally, guys. So we're not talking about just in her state or even just in our country, but really a global enterprise. She's a board certified behavior analyst, a supervisor of upcoming behavior analysts and businesses, and a writer, with one of her most recognized works being OBM Applied! A practical guide for implementing organizational behavior management, with her co-authors Manny Rodriguez and Daniel Sundberg. So today we're going to talk about her top five OBM skills a BCBA should know. But I think a great place to start, Shannon, if it's okay with you, is to give us a little intro or kind of what is OBM?
All right. So organizational behavior management is OBM, and it's the science of human behavior applied at work. So it shouldn't seem conceptually unfamiliar to a lot of behavior analysts, because it's actually a subcategory of applied behavior analysis. And we're using the same behavioral principles that, you know, all of us ABA practitioners know and love, but we're just applying them in a slightly different way to improve people's lives at work, increase productivity, increase safety and customer and employee satisfaction, and a lot more. So that's pretty much OBM in kind of a nutshell of, you know, what do we do?
I think that's great. And I also love that you have been able to narrow that down to like an elevator pitch, because when I was thinking of how would I describe that, right? Or how would I define OBM? And right. I think so much specifics came to my mind from whether it was talks I've attended or the some of FIT's OBM, which is like a million acronyms, but the courses that I took, and I was thinking like these specifics. And so I really appreciate hearing that from a more overarching perspective, because I think sometimes too, or I wonder, I should always take that stance of curiosity. I wonder if maybe people think, well, I'm not a business owner and I really don't want to be. And so that doesn't apply to me. And so I love the idea of looking at systems that are in business and could be a business, but could also be subsystems of that business. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it really does. And one of the things that I run into a lot is when I talk to people about OBM, sometimes they'll tune me out because they'll be like, you know, I don't want to be a consultant. I don't want to grab my briefcase and get on a plane and go, you know, be a, you know, somebody working in these giant skyscrapers. And the reality of it is organizational behavior management is not a consulting skill set. It's a human interaction skill set, you know, just learning how to behave with people and manage people and, you know, work collaboratively. And I really, you know, try to direct people to, you know, this is for everybody. This isn't for just business owners. This isn't just for the person with the briefcase on the airplane. It's if you're working with someone, trying to get some kind of result from really any person, OBM is a fantastic skill set for you to develop.
I agree. And I think that it's not often included in our, in the typical BCBA course sequence. And I understand why. There's just not enough time to do everything. But I also think that this is, as a person who's welcomed new BCBAs into my jobs or worked with new BCBAs, it's that managing of people is really where I think people get stuck in the beginning, right? The easy part, I'm doing air quotes as always, but like the easy part, right, is figuring out, you know, behaviors to increase and decrease in our identified clients or identified patients, which we often use IP as like another acronym in psychology. But the idea is that nobody occurs in a vacuum. And as behavior analysts, we know that behavior is a person interacting with their environment. And our environment as the BCBAs on the case is those RBTs, the parents. How do we really navigate and set up contingencies within each of those systems? And so like each case is almost, I conceptualize as its own system or its own organization, as well as like your coworkers and those that you collaborate with. Or if you're a school teacher, right, each classroom or each small group or each school within each school system, all of these are different systems that I really feel strongly that some understanding of OBM can be invaluable to helping us be more successful. So I'm super excited to hear kind of your top five OBM skills. And maybe we talked a little bit, or I talked a little bit about why this might be important for BCBAs to know about OBM. Is there anything you'd add to that?
Well, and you kind of hit the nail on the head when it comes to this stuff. So, you know, the best laid behavior program put together by a clinical behavior analyst doesn't really amount to much if people aren't implementing your behavior program correctly. So if you don't ensure that the people who are implementing your programs have like clear expectations and the knowledge and skills to actually do what you're asking them to do, and then the motivation to implement your program correctly, if you don't have those things in place, that behavior program is just a piece of paper or a large stack of papers, I guess I should say.
Yep. I love that. I say that all the time. Like, it doesn't matter how great your plan is if nobody's going to do it. And exactly. I have been, and I like, look, I'm not in ivory tower, guys. I have written plans that nobody follows because I have come in there giving directions or thinking, you know, emphasizing on talking about the plan. Reality is that plan, you can't even come in there and talk about it until you've established some contingencies that occasion the ability for people to hear you and want to follow you. And that's where I feel like OBM can really come into play. So I'm excited to talk about that.
Right. And I think a lot of people think about that, you know, employee side, that supervisee side of stuff, and kind of just expect things to fall in place. Mm-hmm. But with our clinical clients, we don't just wing our programming and expect people to behave the way we need them to. So developing the skills to be able to get people to do what you want them to do, especially in an organizational context, it's not a different science, you know?
Right.
And clinical behavior analysts will already understand the principles that we use in OBM because we use positive reinforcement. Mm-hmm. We use least restrictive alternative behaviors. We look at the antecedents and the consequences. We do ABCs like everyone else, and we operationalize behaviors so that they are observable and measurable. And we're looking at the data. You know, if you're not collecting data, you're not doing behavior analysis and you're not doing OBM. So all of this stuff should sound like exactly what a clinical behavior analyst is doing because it's the same science. And a lot of people, I think of OBM as this separate kind of practice area, when in reality, it's the same science. You're just applying it in a slightly different way to get, you know, the results from the people that you need to get results from. Mm-hmm. And ultimately to achieve business results, but more so to make sure your employees are happy and doing what they need to do and are happy doing so.
Absolutely. Because all of that is what either benefits or keeps the doors open, right? So if people aren't happy and people aren't doing what you need them to do or what funders need them to do, then it doesn't matter how great that behavior plan is, or it doesn't matter how awesome your token board is, right? Because there is not a system in place for it to happen.
Right. And you're not measuring it and you're not
Yes.
keeping track of what's happening.
Exactly.
So we wouldn't do that with clinical clients. So why would we do that with our employees who are really clients of our management services? You know.
Exactly. And I love that parallel process, right? The more we can connect things to what we already know helps us to organize it in our mind. And so I love that. So let's get started. I'm sure people are like poised with pen and paper and ready to learn about your top five OBM skills for BCBAs. So what would you say? Should we count down like 5 to 1?
Actually, I would kind of put these all on the same level. So I wouldn't say that they're ranked. But
okay, good to know. Good to know. Everything is important, everyone. Listen up. Don't miss a word. That's what I hear you say.
Yeah, I think these are all really, really valuable skills, and each of them serve kind of a different purpose in your practice. So I really wouldn't rank them. They're kind of all equal, but you individually, you know, as listeners, can rank them based upon what you're experiencing right now in your organization. So if you're not having trouble with problem behavior, then maybe you won't pay attention to one thing. Whereas, you know, maybe you've got an unclear process, you'll pay attention to a different thing. So they're all equal, but you'll be able to rank them based upon your experience.
Perfect. Perfect. I love that. Individualization is key for everything that we do.
Absolutely.
And so what would you like to start with?
Well, usually where I always start is like OBM 101, like the first thing that we really like to master is delivering and receiving feedback.
Love that.
So I know we talk about it a little bit in a lot of supervision courses. It's something that we're required to talk about in the 8 hours is, you know, delivering and receiving. Well, most people don't talk about receiving feedback, but they'll talk about delivering feedback.
Mm-hmm.
But just adding feedback into the environment to tell somebody how they're doing at the work that you're expecting them to do is invaluable. People respond very, very well to feedback because in a lot of job positions, people have no idea how they're performing compared to anybody else or compared to the expectation or compared to benchmarks. So really mastering, delivering, especially constructive feedback in a way that's not aversive, and then learning to deliver a lot more positive feedback. I know people talk about that 4-to-1 ratio of feedback. And for those who don't know, 4-to-1 means 4 positives for every 1 negative. I'm not technically a subscriber to that particular ratio. I think it simplifies things a bit too much.
Mm-hmm.
As like Becca, you just alluded to, we individualize everything. So not everybody's going to want 4 positives to 1 negative. So you're going to cater your ratios based upon how their performance changes. But it's a good guide to get you started in that you don't want to constantly be paired as being the person who comes in and criticizes every time you're in the environment, because then they're not going to want to be around you. So favoring more positive over negative is good. And learning how to do that in an effective way, I think, is one of my top skills.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that it reminds me of something I just posted on Facebook the other day. Maybe it was yesterday. I don't know. The days are blending together, but it was one of Brené Brown videos about blame and sort of responsibility and kind of this idea that sometimes accepting feedback can be hard because you have to be vulnerable, right? When you're taking in that feedback and saying, yes, I can fix that, or even just being open to the idea that what the other person is saying that may be corrective isn't somebody else's fault, right? And so I think that idea, well, and actually I'm having the thought, it's interesting that we so often talk about delivering feedback instead of receiving feedback, because that almost suggests that we would be giving feedback more than receiving it, right? And so then I wonder if we think that we're supposed to be giving more feedback than receiving it, and that that's more important because it's emphasized more in our training. Does that make sense? And yet maybe they're equally important. And so those of us that are doing trainings and facilitating those ongoing education events or, you know, CEUs can kind of take that tidbit. I know I'm going to take that tidbit and be sure that when I'm talking about feedback that I'm very intentionally talking about receiving equally as much as I'm talking about delivering feedback.
And I would absolutely agree, and that's a really good takeaway from this, is that we don't talk about receiving feedback, but if you never solicit other people for feedback, you're never going to be serving as a model for what receiving feedback well looks like. So people don't have those models to emulate. And then, you know, a leader might wonder why whenever I go give constructive feedback, people don't respond well. And part of that is because they don't have good models of people accepting some constructive feedback and implementing the changes and doing it in a way that's just, it's gracious. It's, you know, and thanking people for coming to you with that feedback, because so many people are punished for speaking up about, you know, potential ways that other people could improve what they're doing. It has been so punished in most people. So I think being a model and reinforcing somebody providing you feedback is huge, and we don't talk about it enough.
I would agree for sure. And I know that's something that we talk about a lot at my clinic with new supervisees, because sometimes it's hard. It's maybe harder to take feedback from certain people than others, and talking about what that brings up in us and why that is, and still how to do it anyways, right? Because it takes courage to give feedback that's corrective, no matter who it is. And so we want to recognize the response effort that that person is using to give us feedback.
Absolutely.
All right. What else do you have for us today?
So I would say another one of my skills, and this one is a little bit more concrete of a skill to develop, is process mapping. Process mapping is kind of like our ABA task analyses, but on steroids. So it's adding some other elements that really make very clear a bunch of different things that happen in a process. So in a task analysis, you've basically got a list of steps pretty clearly laying out what needs to be done first, second, third. But in a process map, you also add the elements of who is accountable. And those are usually done in these rows that we call swim lanes. And it's a little hard to describe it in an audio kind of only situation, but there's these like rows that go across, and each of those is a department or an individual who is responsible for a step that goes in that swim lane, as we call them. Mm-hmm. And then you can also add decision points. So in a task analysis, if you had a decision to make, it's really difficult to lay out exactly like, where do I go if this answer is yes or no? Like, do I need to jump down to process step number 12 rather than process step number 6? So just in a process map, it's laid out in a very visual way that you can see the different branches and the different courses of action on that process map. So it's like taking your regular task analysis to another level.
I love that. And I think I love the piece of adding who's going to do what. We have created quite a few process maps, and I'm often surprised by when people, so, and I didn't know they were called swim lanes. I love that. When people aren't sure, let me change that. When I've not been clear to my team about who's responsible for what part. And so just creating those often illuminates when I'm talking with the team that I was thinking that somebody was doing something and they didn't know that they were responsible for it, or that it was, you know, who else could be responsible for it. And then that has clarified and smoothed out a lot more processes. And that's a me error, right? There's not a problem with the process. There was a problem with my explanation of how that was supposed to look. And for leaders, it's been really helpful for me to also see what doesn't have to be mine, right? Mm-hmm. So there are some things as we're like looking at these processes that's like, okay, I don't have to do that. It's a great opportunity to hand something off to somebody else for them to learn something new. And also for me to more fine tune where my time is being spent. So I find them super helpful. I wonder, Shannon, since we're doing like a kind of an intro to a couple different things, maybe we could have some links of where people could go to learn more about some of these that I could put in the show notes. Would that feel okay?
Yeah, I can definitely send some stuff along. There's a lot out there because this isn't technically a behavior analytic tool. This is actually an engineering tool.
I love that.
Engineers actually started doing this to ensure that everything was clear, because when you're doing large engineering projects, it's super important to know who's doing what, who's doing things when. If this doesn't happen, what's our course of action?
Absolutely. I love that. And guys, if it's working for like nuclear situations, then I think it definitely can be used with us. So thank you. Awesome. What would you say is the third skill in OBM, or third OBM, would skill be the right word, or technique? What language would be that?
I guess I wouldn't exactly call them skills. I'd call them like knowledge areas, you know, you should become very aware of and learn a bit more about. And some of them are tools, mm-hmm. like a process map is a tool. And this third one is also a tool. And that is learning to do diagnostics. So when I'm talking about diagnostics, it's the equivalent in a way to our functional behavior assessments clinically. So why is this happening the way that it is? So rather than just making assumptions about, you know, why an employee isn't doing something that they should be doing, there are tools out there like the performance diagnostic checklist that can be used to actually pretty concretely diagnose where things are going wrong. Mm-hmm. So something that often happens in organizations, and this I've addressed this many, many times with clients, is when something's not going right in a process, they'll come to me and say, obviously we need to train more on this. We need a training for this. And I'll usually turn to them and say, you know, if you offered that employee like $1 million to be able to do what you're asking them to do, could they do it? And they're mm-hmm. like, well, of course they could do it. I'm like, well, then you might not want to be investing in training because they've got the skill. They mm-hmm. can do it. There's something else that's not in place. So we need to know how to diagnose the issue before we put a solution in place. Just like with our clinical clients, we don't assume everything is attention maintained. You know, we actually diagnose the issue, and OBM is no different.
I love that. And so you mentioned the performance diagnostic checklist, and I'm wondering if you could give kind of a sentence about what that is for people who might not be familiar with it.
All right. So the performance diagnostic checklist is an indirect tool that we use. So we sit down with the employee. So you want to talk to the direct performer, and the performance diagnostic checklist has four different categories of information that include the antecedents and information. It includes the equipment and processes. It includes the consequences, and it includes, why am I spacing the fourth one? But there are four. And it asks all of these questions within all of these categories. Oh, knowledge and skills. Of course I skipped training. So knowledge and skills, equipment and processes, antecedents and information, and consequences. And it asks questions within each of those categories like, you know, are there job aids available for the task that you're trying to complete? Have you taken coursework in this area? Are you given any reinforcement for the task? And they're worded differently. I'm just kind of summing them up.
Sure.
And you go through the checklist to determine where there are deficits in your management process or your process in general for the behavior that you're expecting. And that allows you to change whatever those checklist items are. So it gives you concrete courses of action of what to do next to fix it.
Fantastic. So again, guys, like Shannon said in the beginning, it's all about the data. It's not, this isn't a different set of skills. It's all maybe using different content areas, but it's using those same skills that we've learned about really making database decisions, intentionally collecting that data, then analyzing it, and then making an intervention plan based on the data, not those cardiac assessments, right? I feel like it could be this, or I feel like it's that. So I love those parallels. And so for people who might be feeling intimidated, or perhaps maybe 20 minutes ago were feeling intimidated about OBM, I'm hoping that you're here a lot of those parallel processes, and that it's not a whole new area. It's taking what you already know and using it in a different way. How about number four?
Yeah, and exactly what you said is going to become very, very apparent with number four. So number four is consequence analysis. So thinking about those ABCs that we already do, except now you're looking at the ABCs of employee behavior, mm-hmm. and you're really taking a very in-depth look at those consequences to determine what is supporting the behavior that we're looking for or is working against us in the behavior that we're looking for our employees to do. And not only that, but what is supporting the alternative behaviors that we don't want to see. So this should sound exactly like what we do with clients. We have, you know, a problem behavior that they're engaging in, and then we've got the, you know, alternative behavior that we want.
Mm-hmm.
So Aubrey Daniels coined a term called picnic.
Yes.
So the picnic analysis is another very concrete tool you guys can go research, or I can provide some links for. And that is looking in a very simple way at whether the consequence of the behavior that you're looking for is positive or negative. And that's not in terms of adding or removing a stimulus like we talk about with positive and negative reinforcement, but positive, do they want it, or negative, do they want to avoid it? Then there's I in picnic, which is immediate or future. So how soon after the behavior is the consequence going to be put in place? And as we know, as behavior analysts, the more immediate the consequence, the better, the more effective that reinforcer or punisher is going to be. And then certain or uncertain. So what are the odds that every time we do that behavior, that outcome is going to happen, that consequence is going to happen? So by looking at this pick-nick analysis, so picks are positive immediate certain and nicks are negative immediate and certain. Those are your most powerful consequences. Anything that's immediate and certain is really, really powerful. So we look at those picks and those nicks for both the behavior we want to see and the alternative behavior that we don't want to see. And we figure out how to tip the scales in favor of what we want people to do versus what we don't want people to do. So that's basically a consequence analysis. And people are shocked when I have them do this, because as soon as they put the alternative behavior that they don't want to see up, they realize that there's a lot more supporting consequences for what they don't want to see. And I think it's hilarious the way people react. They're like, I know where this is going. I know exactly where this is going before they even finish the activity.
Yes, because we are good behavior analysts. And so we are good at looking at this stuff, guys. I know, and I certainly had some of those moments myself in looking at either my own staff or even my own behavior, guys. Sometimes, like, I'll sit down and be like, why do I keep doing this? Or why am I struggling with this? And I kind of map it out and look at it. It's like, oh, because that, right? And so it's easy to see when you can put the pen to the paper or kind of look at our behavior or our staff's behavior or even our colleagues' behavior or parents, right? The parents that we work with, right? Under those same contingencies or laws of behavior that we use when we're looking at our identified client, right? Our primary client, the clinical piece. We're really good and trained at seeing those jump out at us from the data. And I would gently challenge that because we're pretty good at noticing those patterns through the practice we've had, that it'll be an easy movement towards looking for those same types of patterns in organization behavior, in the behavior of our employees or our staff or our colleagues or anyone that whose behavior we're trying to manage, because we are good at identifying those patterns. That's what makes us strong behavior analysts. And these are the same type of patterns, right? What is getting in the way of getting of that behavior that we desire to see? What is getting in the way of that? What are those barriers? And then when you identify it, coming up with a function-based, right, equivalent or something that is going to decrease the barriers to the undesired behavior and increase the likelihood of the desired behavior occurring. Is that right, Shannon? Are we on track here?
You nailed it.
Can you give an example? Because I think this one is super relevant. Is there an example you can think of that comes up for a specific consequence that you see people, or a specific sort of set of behaviors that people are struggling with?
Yeah. So working with my supervisees through SEMO, I was just teaching a few of them about consequence analysis literally yesterday. And my example in what I was providing them was, so let's say the behavior that you want is somebody attending a meeting on time, so arriving to a meeting in a timely manner. But the antecedents for that are that they're not really sure what the meeting is about, and they have a bunch of other tasks on their to-do list. So in order to attend the meeting on time, the consequences for that is that they're losing time to do those other tasks on their checklist. And, you know, they're probably not going to be engaged in the meeting because it might not be relevant to them. And that's going to be one of those uncertain consequences that we talked about. But there's a chance that, you know, they're going to be sitting in another meeting that they didn't really have to be in. And then the alternative behavior that I was looking at, and one of the most common problems that we come up with people doing this for the first time, is that they choose a non-behavior as their alternative.
Yes. So the dead man's test.
Exactly. So if you say, well, of course, our alternative behavior is not showing up to the meeting on time. It's like, well, a dead man could not show up to a meeting on time. In fact, he has never showed up to a meeting on time.
Mm-hmm.
So our alternative behavior is actually them sitting at their desk and completing their other tasks. So they've still got the same antecedents. So they don't know what the meeting was about anyways. They've got that long to-do list. So those consequences, they're actually getting their tasks done. You know, they might miss some valuable information to their work, but that's not certain because they didn't know what the meeting was about. And then they're probably going to get more praise for completing all of their day's work, more so than they would get for showing up to that meeting on time. So
absolutely.
You can see how the scales are tipped towards them sitting at their desk doing work rather than showing up to that meeting on time. So what we take from that information is if we change some of the antecedents, so if we give them the ability to delegate some of those tasks, and we send out an agenda ahead of time and only require them to attend a meeting that they're actually on the agenda for, the odds are is they're going to show up to that meeting on time because they know they're going to get important information about their job. They're going to be engaged in the meeting. And then if they're not on the agenda, then they don't show up and they can still contact reinforcement for completing their tasks. So that's kind of in a nutshell, an overview of a picnic analysis kind of done on the fly here.
I think that's fantastic. And I appreciate you leaning into the potential discomfort of doing that on the fly, because I think examples are helpful, right? So when we're talking about these content areas, we might struggle to come up with how it might be relevant. We're like, oh yeah, that'll be helpful, and not totally sure how. And so I think examples are super helpful.
Yep.
So I appreciate that.
No problem.
Okay. And so here we are at number 5, which is not the most or least important, but is on the same footing as the other 4. And what would that 5th one be?
Well, and I would say that this is one that behavior analysts struggle with the most, 100% the most, because everything else lends itself really well to stuff that we already do. So we talk about feedback. We lay out task analyses. We diagnose our clients and we already do those ABCs. But this one is making sure that we understand the connection between the actual physical behavior and connect it to those outcomes and connect those outcomes to a business result. So a lot of behavior analysts like to stay away from talking about business results, but we have to understand, and employees should really understand, why we're focusing on these particular behaviors. Like looking at the big picture of why is this something that's important to us? And for management, if we're focusing on this, are we tying this to a strategic priority or are we just emphasizing this behavior for behavior's sake? It happens a lot where we're working and reinforcing these behaviors that don't end up actually contributing to the organization.
Can you say more about what you mean?
So there are some organizations that will be focusing on certain behaviors that don't always contribute to a result for the organization. So if we're going to focus on, you know, turning in paperwork on time, can we make the connection to why turning paperwork in on time is important to the organization? Or is the employee just going to see this as my only consequence and the only thing I know about turning in this paperwork is that I put it in this, you know, this file and it's done. I see the connection between that piece of paper and my action and the benefits to the business and what's happening within our organization.
I see. I think that's great because it kind of is talking about that why, right? Like, so for me, I'll take an attempt at that example. So we want people to complete their notes by a certain time. And let's say I'm just telling people it has to be done Thursday at 5 p.m. And I'm having a hard time getting that, you know, staff aren't completing it by Thursdays at 5. Then maybe I would want to let them know why. So it needs to be done Thursdays at 5 because billing is submitted through our electronic records at Friday at 9 a.m. And because it's important to me that you guys aren't working after hours, you know, that your workday ends when you leave the clinic, it needs to be done Thursdays at 5. Is that kind of an example?
Yep. And then you can take it one step further to say, you know, this needs to be in Thursdays at 5 because that's when we send it to the billing company. They need it at 9 o'clock. And that's what helps ensure that our doors stay
open. Yes. Okay, yes. Good. You're right. And so that's interesting, right? Because even in that example, and I think I tend to do this, and so I'm wondering if others may do it too, and talking about, right, I want to talk about how it affects them, right? I don't want them working late. I want to be sure that they've got family time in the evenings, time to unplug from work. And I say it has to be submitted, you know, our billing company submits it Thursday or Fridays at 9. and then I stop there, right? Because there's almost sometimes for me this, I don't want my staff to have to worry about the money stuff that I have to deal with, or I don't want them having to worry about all of that. And while that's true, they also have to know that their behaviors directly contribute to whether we're open or not. They're an important part of that team. And so maybe it's like you said, you know, when we submit billing on time, then we're paid on time, fingers crossed, right? And then that allows me to pay you, and that allows our kids to keep getting services. And so they can know that while not having to know the nitty gritty details of fighting with TRICARE, Blue Cross, or Medicaid, or whatever our funding sources are. So both of those can be true. You want to give them enough to know that why what they're doing matters. And that doesn't mean you have to tell them everything.
Exactly. And even at a leadership level, I think we forget to, let's say somebody says that they want to work on training. Mm-hmm. So how do we tie training to a business result that makes that really important? So of course you've got your clinical results. So better training equals, you know, better outcomes for clients. But if we improve our training systems, can we reduce our expenses, which then can be used for other things? So yes. Digitizing training, like how much is our training costing us?
Yes,
and then if we know what training is costing us, we can also calculate the cost of turnover.
Mm-hmm.
So if it costs us, you know, $5,000 to train somebody to be an RBT, then maybe we should be putting more resources into retention. So it can lead to a number of different other things when we're looking at the behavior of, you know, providing training in the context of the business as a whole. And I think a lot of behavior analysts try to stay away from that stuff, but that's what keeps your doors open. And like you said, it allows you and gives you the opportunity to serve your community. And if your doors don't stay open, you know, you can't help anybody, and you're not helping your employees, and you're not helping, you know, the individuals who need our services as clinicians.
Absolutely. And I love that in your example, you're talking about, because the retention piece, which you could do a whole other session on. But I think we often look at initiating that behavior change, right? So people may focus a ton on onboarding. How do we make that efficient? How do we do that well? But that's just the beginning of the behavior, right? We have to have planned in ongoing maintenance of that behavior, just like to, again, make a parallel to our clinical application. We may teach a behavior, but then we're regularly assessing it. We're regularly doing error corrections and feedback, and we're regularly doing booster sessions when needed. And so making sure that we're planning for not just the teaching of that behavior, but the maintenance ongoing and generalization of those behaviors, just like we do in our clinical applications. Is that correct?
Exactly. You got it.
Perfect. Well, Shannon, do you want to give us a brief summary of your just the five content areas you taught us today?
Absolutely. So what I consider the top five OBM skills every behavior analyst should know, in no particular order, we have delivering and receiving feedback. We have process mapping. We have performance diagnostics, our consequence analysis. And finally, that last one that we talked about, which is connecting the behaviors to the business results. So those are the things that you guys should go ahead and Google. And I will provide Becca with some links to share with you guys to explore these areas a bit more. And it's really just the tip of the iceberg of what OBM is. But these are the areas that, as you know, clinicians and as business owners, I would prioritize to really start digging into.
Perfect. Well, Shannon, I want to be mindful of your time since it's one of our most precious because of its limited resources. So everybody who's tuning in, the same goes for you guys. If it's your first time joining us, I really appreciate you tuning in, and hopefully you found some gems today. And for our regular listeners, I appreciate you coming back time and time again. That is what lets me know that there is value in what we're providing and that I should continue to do it. Just as we've talked about with Shannon today, I am regularly looking at the data of downloads and subscribes and comments and feedback to be sure that this is a good use of time and that it is providing value to our community. So I hope that you guys have a great rest of your day, and I look forward to seeing those of you guys online in the ABA Business Builders Facebook group or getting emails or feedback. So thanks again for joining us on the Business of Behavior podcast, and I hope you have a great rest of your day. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everybody.